From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young in Philly. It's Here and Now. And tonight, another first. Hillary Clinton will be the first woman to accept a major party nomination. And in one of those weird parallel realities with the RNC last week, where Ivanka introed her dad, Donald, Hillary will be introduced by her daughter, Chelsea. And they have a hard act to follow after last night.
No matter where you were raised, how can there be pleasure in saying you're fired? He's trying to tell us he cares about the middle class. Give me a break. That's a bunch of malarkey.
If any of you are looking for that party of Lincoln, we've got a home for you right here in the Democratic Party.
We battled for a year and a half. Let me tell you, it was tough. Because Hillary was tough. I was worn out. She was doing everything I was doing, but just like Ginger Rogers, it was backwards in heels.
This morning, this very morning, he personally invited Russia to hack us. That's not law and order, that's criminal intent.
Time and again, you've picked me up. And I hope sometimes I picked you up too. And tonight, I ask you to do for Hillary Clinton what you did for me. I ask you to carry her the same way you carried me.
President Obama, before him, former Rear Admiral Navy General John Hudson talking about Donald Trump and Russia, Vice Presidential candidate Tim Kaine with the Lincoln quote, and Joe Biden started us off with, "You're fired." Joining us now, NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, who's been covering the Clinton campaign. Tam, following them wherever they go, but they just announced the final program for tonight. Now, Hillary Clinton, obviously the headliner and closer, but who's lined up and what do they have to do? Will they be attacking Donald Trump the way speakers did last night?
There's quite a lineup tonight. It's sort of a grab bag. There's going to be a retired Marine General, John Allen. There are going to be family members of fallen police officers, as well as a family member of one of the Muslim soldiers killed in the war on terror. A number of lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, but also reaching across the aisle, there will be the co-founder of GOP Women for HRC. There is going to be sort of a mix of what the campaign would call post-partisan outreach, as well as more partisan speeches. You can no doubt expect at least some veiled or not so veiled attacks on Donald Trump. That has been sort of a staple of the whole week. But I think that's probably not where Hillary Clinton is going with her speech.
Right. And it's interesting you mentioned that they will have family members of a fallen police officer, because that was the criticism from the other night, that they had mothers of children taken by violence but hadn't had officers taken by violence. So that's interesting. Just want to get your thoughts. You've been covering the White House for a few years. On President Obama's speech last night.
Yeah, it was classic President Obama. He came into office as this incredible, inspiring orator, and this speech was in line with that. He had sort of the peaks and the valleys, the crescendos, that he would get quiet and then he would get loud, and he had the crowd with him the entire time. There is sort of a parallel here. 4 years ago, Bill Clinton came to President Obama's convention and made a case for President Obama that was a stronger case than President Obama made for himself. And one could argue that the Obama administration in this, President Obama, Michelle Obama, Joe Biden, have been making a case for Hillary Clinton that it would be hard for her to make herself.
Yeah. Well, and how much is Hillary Clinton going to continue to embrace, as she did last night, the Obama presidency when she speaks tonight? What do you think she's going to say?
Well, her campaign says that she's been working on this speech for a while now, that even after last night she made that surprise visit on stage, she went back to her hotel and worked on it some more. They expect her to keep working on it up to the very last minute, which is sort of classic Clinton speech writing. And they say that she will build on the themes of her book from 1996, It Takes a Village. She has this campaign slogan that's relatively new, Stronger Together. It's been a big part of this convention. And they see Stronger Together as an extension of the It Takes a Village idea, which goes all the way back to the way she was raised in Park Ridge, Illinois, in the 1950s and 60s.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, as we get set to hear Hillary Clinton accept her party's nomination tonight. Tam, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, let's step away from Philly and politics for a moment and move to public health in Colorado. You'll recall that the state legalized recreational marijuana there in 2012 and sales began in 2014. Since then, there's been a significant spike in the number of children who've been hospitalized after accidentally consuming marijuana products. And the most frequent calls to poison control centers in Colorado are now related to marijuana ingestion. Those are the findings in a new study published in the journal JAMA Pediatrics this week. Dr. Sam Wang is lead author on the study. He's a physician and medical toxicologist at the Department of Pediatrics at the Children's Hospital in Aurora, Colorado. He's also an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Colorado, and he joins us from Denver. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, when we say that exposure had increased in children, by how much? What are we talking about?
Great question. You know, the gross numbers, we looked at poison center exposure calls and then our hospital visits at Children's Hospital Colorado in children 9 years and younger, and we saw that the gross numbers went up. So in 2009, we had one child visit us at the hospital for a marijuana exposure, and in 2015, we had 16. And exposure phone calls to our regional poison center here in our state went up fivefold. And so again, the trend is there. Numbers are low. But I think as more states think about legalization and marijuana becomes more a commonplace and more available in the home, kids may be prone to getting into them.
Mm. And how is it that these children are ingesting these high levels of marijuana? They're not. Is it secondhand smoke? I mean, I presume they're not smoking it themselves.
Yeah, great question. You know, we saw a large percentage of these kids where ingestion was the route of exposure. And a lot of them actually got into marijuana-infused edible products or candies and baked goods. And for a child to get into them, they look very similar to a non-infused edible product with higher amounts of THC, the psychoactive ingredient of marijuana, in them. And at their small size and stature and weight and the amount of THC they get into them, they can potentially get sick.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about that. What's the difference in terms of how a child's body reacts to ingesting THC versus an adult?
Yeah, a child's reaction's quite different. We see a lot more sleepiness or somnolence, we call it, lethargy. We call it ataxia or inability to walk on their own. And the most extreme circumstances we've seen was where small children have gotten too much, actually had impaired their ability to breathe well, and some actually kids had to be on a mechanical ventilator from these exposures.
Wow. Okay. And you have seen cases like that. But I'm curious, though. Colorado requires that recreational marijuana be sold in child-resistant packaging. So what's going on there? I mean, how is it just that, you know, families are leaving it lying around outside of the packaging?
You know, we hypothesize that child-resistant packaging has been around for a couple of years now in our state for marijuana. And if it wasn't around, we might have had an even higher increase. But we don't know. Colorado has been great in working with the industry and the legislators and the healthcare community and public health officials to try to help do things to curb these unintentional exposures. So child-resistant packaging is one thing that we've implemented, dose regulations for the amount of THC that are in these products, opaque packaging, the inability to have many mass marketing campaigns, you know, public education that's gone on supported by the Colorado Department of Public Health. So there's been a bunch of things going on in our state, and I think a lot of the other states that have also legalized have also followed suit and have done things similar to us.
Mm. You know, I have to say, I think that most, if not all, parents are pretty well versed in how to keep kids safe from typical pharmaceuticals, right? You know, keep it in the child-resistant bottle. You put it in the medicine cabinet. Keep it out of a kid's reach. You know, tell the kid it's not candy, all of that stuff. What's your advice to parents about how to, you know, keep kids safe from accidental exposure to marijuana, especially if so much of the ingestion that you're seeing is coming through these edibles?
Yeah, I think the message we like to tell families and caregivers of children is you just have to treat it like any other product in the home that you use caution with, whether that's alcohol, whether that's cigarettes, whether that's your pharmaceutical drugs, over-the-counter prescription, your household chemicals. You have to keep them up and out of reach, locked away, keep them in their child-resistant packaging. Don't put them next to normal food products, and educate people who may be caring for your children who have these products in their home. And I think you just have to be aware that if a child were to get into them, and which would potentially happen if they saw it because they don't know the difference, they could potentially get sick as well. So we just want to make sure people are aware of that and properly store them and educate all their caregivers about it.
Well, Dr. Sam Wang is a medical toxicologist at the Department of Pediatrics at the Children's Hospital in Colorado. He's also an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Colorado. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Here and Now at the DNC in Philly. Tonight, Hillary Clinton formally accepts her party's nomination, another step in a political career launched in the campaign she won, becoming president of the class of 1969 at Wellesley. And with her then and now, Suzanne Solomon. They were dorm suite mates for 3 years. Suzanne is here as a guest of Hillary's and is wearing two big buttons. Suzanne, a lot of women are wearing the another Wellesley woman for Hillary, but you have the coveted one that says Hillary's Wellesley class. How many women are wearing that?
About 8 or 9.
Really?
And, yes.
And what does that say to you? What does that mean to you, that button?
It flashes pride and support and commitment to a wonderful person and a fabulous human being whom I've known all these years.
Well, and someone you and other women at Wellesley got to see evolve. She was famously a Republican Goldwater supporter, a Republican for Goldwater in 68-69, president of the Young Republicans when she was at Wellesley.
But that was earlier on.
Obviously there was change. Did you watch that evolution?
Yes, of course, because we lived 10 feet from each other for 3 years. Yes, she became increasingly interested in more liberal issues and social causes and became more and more committed to civil rights and social good as we went along.
Well, and remind us why. This is a tumultuous time period, and she has said she grew up in a moderately well-off suburb. Her dad was a Republican. She said she never saw any black people unless they worked for her dad or in her home. But yet, as everyone was watching on the television screens as what was happening.
There were riots in the street. There were sit-ins, and this was the era of Martin Luther King. Tremendous activity in the civil rights movement. It was the Vietnam War era when many of our contemporaries were protesting the war.
And serving.
And serving.
Yeah.
Yes.
And this is the era of the draft. And you mentioned Martin Luther King. Karen Williamson, who is, you're smiling, one of your fellow Wellesley students, was one of the, I think, 4 or 5 black students at Wellesley at the time. And she told The New Yorker that when King was assassinated, Hillary Clinton was the only one who called her to offer, you know, sympathy.
That doesn't surprise me. Hillary is a person of tremendous sympathy and empathy. Many people think of her as cold and remote, but she's anything but that. She's a very loyal friend. She's very compassionate. She's there for the people she cares about. And it's unfortunate that she's developed a reputation for not being that way. She's remained a very loyal, good friend to those of us who were close to her then and still are now.
Well, I have to say it's astonishing to see the parade of people who talk about having met her decades ago and she still keeps in touch. I don't know how she managed to also be Secretary of State and keep in touch with, you know, a senator and keep in touch with the people that she has. But, you know, you say that the reputation that she has for being aloof doesn't match your reality, but it is a reality for so many people. Why do you think it is that Hillary Clinton does come across as somewhat aloof when she's speaking publicly?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. Maybe she's more effective one-on-one. I mean, I've seen so many examples of her being there for people. When Bill was in the White House, for example, there was a lot going on with various personal issues of his. And
You're talking about the Monica Lewinsky scandals. Yeah,
yes, okay. and the other scandals. And Hillary, most of the time, appeared by his side in the Rose Garden, and one day she was not there. And the press were speculating why she wasn't there. And the reason she wasn't there is because her Wellesley roommate was in the hospital in Boston having some major surgery, and she flew up to Boston to be with Johanna because Johanna was a really close personal friend of hers, and she wanted to be with her.
Huh. And of course, she did not advertise that.
Of course not. Yeah. Nobody knew except those of us who were in her little circle.
Tell us more about how you think Wellesley formed her, or she even formed Wellesley. I mean, Madeleine Albright, you know, on stage the other night, said she and Hillary have some things in common, including being Secretary of State, and also went to Wellesley. And so she said she knows where she got her study habits. Tell us about her reputation as a student.
Oh, she was a superb student. Not only was she president of the student body, which people know, but she was an outstanding political science major, very close to her advisor there, Alan Schechter, who was a marvelous professor of political science. Wellesley women like to have fun, but for the most part were very studious, very diligent, very conscientious.
She was president of everything, but you could also get the sense that there was a moment where she was definitely moving away from that good, perfect student, and that was at your commencement speech.
Yes.
She was the very first student commencement speaker at Wellesley in 69, and right before her, the invited speaker, Republican Senator Edward Brooke from Massachusetts, spoke, and by some accounts was kind of dismissive of the young women in front of him. And she got up and diverted from her text. Let's listen to just a little bit.
We've had lots of empathy, we've had lots of sympathy, but we feel that for too long our leaders have viewed politics as the art of the possible. And the challenge now is to practice politics as the art of making what appears to be impossible possible.
Do you remember that?
Of course. I was there among all of us who stood up and cheered for her.
For 7 minutes?
Yes, for 7 minutes.
Because why? Yeah.
She spoke for us. He spoke to us and at us, but not for us. And she voiced many of our feelings about and frustrations about the state of the world at that time. She was a hugely powerful speaker right then and there.
Well, and I'm not even going to ask you, Suzanne, if you ever thought she'd be president, because we understand that there was a sheet of paper on one of the dorms during the last week of your senior year. People wrote down predictions for what would happen, and it was predicted on that sheet of paper that Hillary Clinton would be the first female president of the United States. You're not there yet, but you guys are not surprised.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Suzanne Solomon, Wellesley class of 1969. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Wow, hearing Hillary Clinton take on a senator in 1969, that was something. Well, let's check in with here now is Peter O'Dowd, downtown at the Philadelphia Convention Center, where Democrats have been gathering all week in caucus meetings. Yes, there's actually a lot of work that gets done at conventions. And one of the more high-profile meetings today, the Women's Caucus. Peter, what are people talking about there? What was on the agenda?
Well, it's a pretty festive day here downtown. This is day four of the convention. It's the final day at this Women's Caucus. Obviously, a lot of people down here really looking forward to this evening when the first woman of a major political party will accept the nomination for president. So really good feelings for the people at this event today. I caught up with a woman named Chanel Butler. She's just 22 years old. She's from Philly, and she was describing how all week is so important to her. Let's listen to some of that conversation.
The other night when Clinton appeared via video conference at the convention, she said, for young women watching, and maybe a young woman like yourself, you might be next. Was that inspiring?
It was really inspiring. I was actually there. I'm actually one of the volunteers for the floor operations in the convention. Seeing it in person and seeing her yesterday coming out with Barack, it was magical. You don't really understand something until you're actually in the environment. You feel the energy, and it makes you more connected to it. And it makes me feel like I can do more than you know what people are imposing on me.
and Robin, there were chants this morning. When Democrats win, when women vote. That was the message at this caucus.
And high-profile names. Tell us more about who was in the room.
Really high-profile names. Shonda Rhimes, the TV producer and writer, was there. Deborah Messing, the actress from Will and Grace. Lily Ledbetter, people know her as an advocate for equal pay rights. But also Cecile Richards, the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood, who gave a rousing speech to the crowd and had no kind words for Donald Trump.
He wants to punish women who have had abortions. And, of course, he has said that pregnancy is an inconvenience for employers. So, as I'm going to say now every single day this fall, Mr. Trump, women are going to be a lot more than an inconvenience. We're going to be the reason you are not elected president of the United States.
Ms. Richards there, of course, the daughter of Ann Richards of Texas, yeah. So continuing some of her mom's tradition of, you know, being, you know, sort of the firebrand. But, Peter, we have to note, according to a Wall Street Journal poll, Hillary Clinton is still struggling with female voters.
I think that's very important to point out. These are some of Hillary Clinton's biggest fans here at this convention in Philadelphia right now, but especially white middle-aged women surprisingly don't go for Hillary Clinton. And so that's something that she's going to really have to focus on going into November, is trying to bring those voters into the fold. She does very well with young voters, young women, millennials, and she also does very well with older women. But it's that center middle-aged demographic there that she's going to have to do a little bit better with.
And, of course, Republicans would say, well, that's not surprising at all. And they would list the reasons that, you know, women might not be comfortable around Hillary Clinton. But remind us, she's going to be speaking tonight. In terms of the Democratic platform, what are the biggest issues this election for the female voters that you're speaking with?
Right. A lot of talk about pay equity today. A lot of talk about access to affordable child care, sick pay and leave policies at work. And also especially focusing on these issues for women of color and minorities, because the people here say that group in particular really struggles in America on those issues. So that's what they'll be looking for from Hillary Clinton tonight.
Our Peter O'Dowd at the Philadelphia Convention Center, where there's tons of caucuses going on. There's a farmers caucus. There's just a lot going on down there. And Peter, we have to just go see who's warming up here. So thank you.
Take care.
It's Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
So here's a direct quote from a document NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman sent to U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal's office. It goes, quote, "The science regarding CTE, including on the asserted link to concussions, remains nascent." He's referring to CTE, the degenerative brain disease. And if it sounds familiar, that's because for years the NFL made the same assertion, until this year when an NFL official admitted there in fact is a link. So what's going on with pro hockey now? Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com, and he joins us now. Hi there, Mike.
Hello.
So first of all, what prompted Bettman to start talking about this?
Well, what's nascent about the link? I mean, that is true. It is in its early stages. We haven't known that much about CTE and concussions for 50 years, but there certainly seems to be a link. The best researchers will say a link. And what really is nascent is the spot where the NHL is in the legal process. So the NFL, I don't think they've entirely put the CTE problem behind them, but they at least have a agreement with hundreds of former players, a court agreement that locks up that problem and doesn't threaten revenues from CTE. And NHL is not in that position. So what we're seeing now is Gary Bettman essentially borrowing from the nascent playbook of any sports league that sees its bottom line threatened from suits by its players.
Gotcha. Now, and just to be clear, he also pointed out that the causal link, which is a key word, between concussions and CTE, quote, has not been demonstrated. But tell me more about the legal position the NHL finds itself in, because there is a class action lawsuit brought by some former players.
Some former players, it's in the very low double digits, and it is also true that the NFL's settlement did not establish that causal link. It was a settlement. It wasn't a court case. Another factor is that the NHL doesn't make nearly as much money as the NFL, though they're not getting sued by nearly as many players. So we're seeing the NHL acting like a business on the defensive, where a lot of facts are aligned against it. They're worried about how much money they could lose. And so that's why we're seeing these, you know, these stretches in terms of the medical claims. Although I would not defer medicine to the commissioners of a professional sports league.
Right. I mean, in fact, the commissioner also argued that he says football and hockey are two very different sports and the injury risks aren't the same. Your take on that?
That is true, but I would also point out, so it's true that in the NFL, the way to stop every single play is for someone to be knocked out of bounds or driven into the ground, unless it's an incompletion. And in the NHL, while hitting is part of the game, it's not essential to stopping play. However, the NHL countenances fist fights.
Right.
And a few of these players who are suing, they're not suing perhaps for being, you know, crushed to the ice as much as they are being hit in the head by a league that allows that.
Yeah. So it just makes me wonder. I mean, the NHL now is showing us that any professional sport where head injuries are not uncommon, they've got to be wondering, like, are we next? Are we going to find our players having had suffered?
That's right. And with time, it will probably be, once you have people stop denying the link, it will be known, and perhaps the courts will look at it like, well, players knew this risk. But especially for the players who are suing, they could argue that a lot of the findings were sat upon or not divulged right to them.
Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst, and he hosts The Gist at Slate.com. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
Last week during the RNC, we traveled outside the Quicken Loans Arena in a beautifully spiffed up downtown Cleveland to East Cleveland, where housing activists are trying to knock down hundreds of horribly blighted buildings to create green space and new homes. Well, here in Philadelphia, they're a step ahead. Development is booming, and it's a big push to replace the city's more than 30,000 abandoned lots and buildings. So how's that going for longtime residents? The little neighborhood of Poplar in North Philadelphia is not unlike other parts of the city. Originally made up of mostly single-family row houses, now it's a patchwork of those old homes, vacant lots and blighted buildings, and also fresh new apartment complexes and coffee houses. It's a drastic change from the 70s and 80s and the vicious cycle of crime and economic decline, helping create blight, which harbored more crime. Arthur Green lives in Poplar. He's been in Philadelphia for decades.
I remember when this neighborhood was severely blighted. All right, a lot of abandoned houses, a lot of boarded up houses, a lot of neglected lots. All right. And they came with the tax abatements, you know, started getting new investors to come into the community. And as a result, you have all this. Like, if you look right down here. All right, this used to be a parking lot, just like this. But now we got all these homes coming up in here. When you get on Poplar Street, back 20 years ago, that land over there was blighted. Now there's, ooh, baby. All right, you know. I mean, those houses are $500,000 a piece. All right.
Well, but so is that a good thing? I would think it'd be a good thing. They're pretty. They look new.
It's a good thing because you have to look how the city generates revenue. All right. And then you want people to come into the city and stay in the city. So they want good housing, good schools. You know, they want to be safe.
So what's the downside?
Well, the downside is, especially in this area, has been gentrification. All right. The people that have stayed here when the neighborhood wasn't so favorable. Now their taxes went up, you know, and they're on fixed incomes. So now they choose to sell their homes. And then some people made the choice. You know, they figured when they bought their homes, they might have bought their homes for $12,000. Now they could sell it for $180,000. Yeah, some people went for that.
But then you can't remain in the community because you can't buy back in because everything's gone up.
You go someplace else. Well, that's a personal choice.
Well, so so people who have been here for decades, who were the backbone of the community, are leaving. And let's be clear, many of them are African American, and many of the people who can afford to move in are white.
Right, but that's America. We know about, and I'll be blunt with you. America is, white supremacy. If you look at the history, all right. I was born in Little Rock, Arkansas. Okay, I saw the KKK march. All right. So we weren't always, treated right or fairly in the land of the free. All right. Yeah. So obviously we're behind on education, behind on the opportunities of housing. We're still fighting for those same things today.
Well, do you think that whites moving into this neighborhood will mean that it will improve those things, education and such? Or are you worried because of the history, as you said, of white supremacy?
Yeah, but things are changing. Things are changing. And I understand it's not all white people that think like that. It's people in high places that thought like that. I mean, we're a mixed world. Sooner or later, we got to learn how to get along.
How much did you buy your house for? And when did
this is public housing here. All right. So this is, and we need more of that.
So you live in public housing. Does that worry you even more because you don't have mobility?
I'm concerned that eventually, because of the upscale of the neighborhood, that PAJ might sell this.
PAJ?
Yeah, public housing. They might sell this property, and then we'll have to move someplace else. Yeah. But hey, they've been talking about that as long as I've been here. So far, we're still here. And I used to be homeless.
Really?
Yeah. I used to live right here in this parking lot.
It's right across the street.
And on that ramp. Okay? For 5 years.
Well, obviously.
And now I'm the ward leader here.
Now you're the ward leader and you were sleeping on the concrete.
That's right.
Well, and now you're going to have a neighbor one block in the other direction who bought a house for $500,000.
Yeah.
Is there something good about that, too, that they may get to experience in meeting you, a person they might not have met otherwise? I mean, you're going to be meeting them, but they're also going to be meeting you.
I think it's good that like I said, it's good that we learn how to get along.
Not everyone here agrees with Arthur that change has a potential good side and is inevitable. Just ask his neighbor a few blocks away, Diane Monroe.
If change is what Arthur, says is beyond our control, that's not a good change.
Diane was born and raised in Philly and bought her home here 35 years ago.
Even though you have maybe better quality houses or, the increase of the people, to me it has gotten worse. It has gotten worse because our community is dirtier. We're no longer considered as a community. You don't know your next-door neighbor. And the new people, they don't speak. When you speak to them, they don't speak to you. That's my opinion.
It's not just the change in the character of the neighborhood that bothers Diane. As Arthur said, there's a financial cost. Her property values and her taxes were set to triple. Now, we'd wondered, why can't the city give a tax break to longtime residents?
Well, we actually have a program just like that in the city of Philadelphia called LOOP. It's the Longtime Owner-Occupant Program.
That's Ann Fedulin, director of the Planning and Development Cabinet for Philadelphia. And that LOOP program is what kept Diane's taxes from skyrocketing, although they did go up some. Ann says that improving the city is a balance of combating blight with new development without pushing people out.
So if you've been in your house for 10 years or more and you have a certain income and your taxes go up by a certain percent, sort of a big increase, you can actually enter this program where your taxes are frozen for 10 years. And recently, I believe in the last session, City Council extended it. So once that 10-year period is up, if you still own your home, you can reapply and keep doing that until such time as you sell your house. So we're trying to keep homeowners and those folks in the communities. I think the trickier part is what do you do about the rental units? And so we also have a provision in our code that allows developers to get a density bonus if they provide affordable units on site or invest in the housing trust fund we have here in the city.
And yet you still have this issue of, some blacks feeling like it's a purge, that they're being purged from their neighborhood.
And I think it's important that we recognize and acknowledge that and not sort of sweep that under the rug or say, yeah, but look at what's happening in your neighborhood or look at this.
It's a nicer neighborhood that you just had to leave.
Yeah, and that's not okay, right? It's not okay to have that as your answer. So I think we have to start by listening and find out what are the amenities that are important to them and what are the things that they really value in their neighborhood and try to build off of those things. But honestly, we also need a national housing policy. We need some help. Our budgets have just been drastically cut, and we can't do it by ourselves. We really need to view housing as a moral issue and a human right, and we need to fund it.
Well, you've got the Democratic Party in town. You've had the Obama administration in charge. What would you say to Hillary Clinton?
That we need resources, and we need real resources, and that it's not just an economic or a development issue, but it's a moral issue, and everybody deserves a place to call home. And
wait, did you get federal dollars for housing?
Our federal dollars have been cut by almost 50% over the last 10 to 12 years, and the implication of that is literally hundreds of millions of dollars in investment, because every federal dollar we get, we then leverage that with private and state and local dollars. And so maybe we get one federal dollar and we leverage it 10, 14 times over. So when we lose, you know, $50 million, that really is literally hundreds of millions of dollars worth of affordable housing.
Well, we leave you with closing thoughts from Arthur about his changing Philadelphia community.
But when it comes down to change, everything changes. Nothing stays the same. As beautiful as you are right now, all right? There was a time you were more vibrant. Then we get older, and we change. I'm not going to have a 28-inch waist anymore, okay? But everything changes. But it's your attitude that needs to change, too.
Arthur Green, resident and ward leader in the Poplar neighborhood in North Philly. We also heard from Ann Fedulin of the city's planning and development cabinet, and another resident, Diane Monroe, who is against the gentrification, as she calls it, of her neighborhood. You going through this where you live? Send us your thoughts at hereandnow.org. More than one in 500 children in the U.S. is born deaf or hard of hearing. And for those kids and their families, sign language is a vital means of communication. But technological advances, including cochlear implants, now give many children the ability to hear and communicate with spoken English from the time they're babies. Elizabeth Fiedler of The Pulse at Here and Now contributor WHYY looks at how technology is changing the role of sign language.
When the world gets too loud, or just to take a quiet break on the weekends, Sophie knows what to do.
When it's really loud, I just take the magnet off.
Sophie's 8. She's deaf and has a cochlear implant that's helped her hear since she was 1. But she knows by moving that magnet, she can stop the device from bringing her sound.
We didn't ever want our daughter to think that she's broken or, you know, not complete somehow.
Her mom, Samantha Zwislak, is sitting on the couch in their living room next to Sophie. She says getting her daughter a cochlear implant, which requires surgery, was a difficult decision.
We wanted to make sure that she knew, you know, we're not trying to fix something on you to make you be a particular way. But at the same time, there is this really neat technology that if you're the appropriate candidate and if you do it soon enough, children who are deaf have access to sound and can use their voice if they choose to speak.
Sophie can hear now and make her own decisions about how to communicate. Even though her parents signed to her, Sophie responds to them in spoken English. When her mom asks why, Sophie explains that they can hear, so she wants to speak. Zwislak says she wants her daughter, who attends the Pennsylvania School for the Deaf, to have the power to define her own identity.
Ultimately, at the end of the day, that child's going to grow up regardless, and they're going to find out who they are. And it might be hearing, it might be deaf. And we have chosen to accept that, you know, Sophie very well, she already identifies as being deaf, and we're comfortable with that. She's looking forward to going to the Deaf University. She wants to go to Gallaudet. We're very proud of that.
Other children who are deaf or hard of hearing are on a different educational path, where sign language is much less visible. Caroline Linz's 7-year-old son, Teddy, was born deaf and uses cochlear implants. He does not know sign language, neither does his family. At 6, he started mainstream schooling after going to one of the Clark Schools for Hearing and Speech, where children use amplification to access sound, including cochlear implants and hearing aids. The school teaches listening and spoken language, but not sign language.
The communication that we have in our family is spoken language. It's not sign language. And for us,
we felt that that bond and that communication was important.
Lynns thinks often about how Teddy's life would have been different if he'd been born 10, 20 years ago. And she thinks about the role that technology plays in his life now.
In addition to his cochlear implant, he has an FM system, which he uses at school, which is a way for the teacher to speak directly into his implant, so it blocks out all the peripheral sounds.
Still, some in the deaf community emphasize the importance of sign language. Sign language is Ron Burdett's primary means of communication. He does not have a cochlear implant and says sign language is part of his identity. Here, he speaks through interpreter Brad Holt.
I'm very proud of deaf culture, deaf history. My parents are deaf. The day that I was born, we immediately started to communicate without any type of struggle.
Burdett believes American Sign Language, ASL, helps build identity and self-esteem for children who are deaf.
There's no limitation to what you can communicate about in sign language. And parents nowadays have actually realized that sign language is a real independent language that comes with its own culture. So I don't think ASL will decline as technology improves.
Back in Sophie's living room, the 8-year-old is talking about a contestant on a recent TV show.
He was on Dancing with the Stars and he's deaf, and he was the only deaf person who was dancing with the stars. Mm-hmm. And I think it was cool.
The actor, Niall DeMarco, has become a role model for lots of kids since appearing on Dancing with the Stars. DeMarco advocates for deaf children to get greater access to sign language, and he doesn't have cochlear implants. He is a big deal to a lot of people in the deaf community. A minute into an energetic dance routine that's modeled on the movement of Spanish bullfighting, the show cuts the music. And DeMarco keeps dancing. Viewers get to imagine how challenging it is for DeMarco to dance. For Sophie and other kids who are deaf or hard of hearing, role models like DeMarco show the abundance of choices that exist for people who are deaf. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler.